Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on. Not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Jason Leopold of TruthOut.org, and you're listening to Carson's Corner, only on Underground Progressive Radio.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner, and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
Welcome live to a late night edition of Carson's Corner, 12:04 Eastern Standard Time, while most people are sleeping, getting ready to go to their menial job. Bob Carson is broadcasting you to you here in the early hours of the morning. And you know, they say the more intelligent people are up at night. We're up till about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning while the rest of the world sleeps, I guess. Who knows, folks? I just wanted to do a show today. It's been a while since I did a solo show here, and we're trying to get the chat room open. I don't know what's going on with the chat room. It's been trying to load for some time now, and I really don't know. So hopefully we can get the chat room open during the course of the show. If not, You could feel free to give me a call at 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. We have a caller right now. Looks like somebody's calling in via Skype. Let me try to go to them here before we kick things off. Yes, hello, welcome to Carson's Corner.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, what's up?
I was just listening to the show, you know, trying to get some intellectual stimulation. Saw the title. I know you haven't gotten into the show, so I was waiting to, you know, see, you know, where the conversation was going to go.
All right, cool. Yeah, so you want to just kind of audit, or you want me to bring you on the line in a little while, or what do you want me to do?
I mean, I can just you know, sit here in silence and, you know, let you, you know, get into, you know, obviously, you know, you got to start off with some sort of monologue and,
yeah,
and then, you know, so.
All right.
You know,
well,
I
cool. I'll get going on my rant here, and then maybe if you're still around in a little while, I'll bring you on, see if you have any comments or questions or concerns or anything, my friend.
Okay.
Thank you, brother. All right, that's cool. You know, that's cool that there are people out there that are intrigued by the title, because as we've said often on this program, you're not going to get really such analysis or anybody even questioning capitalism on the corporate-owned media, and I think that's for obvious reasons. With the exception possibly of RT, but RT is not, I wouldn't consider that corporate media. That's definitely outside the box alternative media. Russia Today, which features a lot of radical hosts on that network. I don't have a television, unfortunately, so I can't really view RT programming. Only online I can view RT program. But you've got Tom Hartman, who Christopher Alan Driscoll of the Election Boycott Advocate says that is the most right-wing host on RT. That's pretty interesting. And you've got some other people on there. Lee Camp, who's been on this program before, I believe he has a show on RT. Peter Lavelle, who we spoke about last week on this show, but besides RT, you're really not going to get an analysis of capitalism. Capitalism is here to stay, and, you know, one smart person out there said it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism, and I think that's absolutely correct. It's completely ingrained in us. You know, there's just no question. It's not up for debate, our economic system. And, you know, I believe, and I'm starting to come around, and keep in mind, folks, some of you may have been listening since 2008, but maybe people haven't. In 2008, I was a supporter of President Obama. Okay, I was really inspired by the Obama campaign, which was truly revolutionary, at least in terms of the words he was using and the image of the candidate. I mean, President Obama was a great speaker. He was a great campaigner. He was the right candidate at the right time, so we thought, you know, we had the 2008 collapse. We lost millions and millions of jobs during the last 6 months of the Bush administration. There was a real need for change, and President Obama at the time was young. He was inspiring, and a lot of people, including myself, the younger demographic at that time, really bought the rhetoric and bought the image sold to us and thought that Obama was going to be an agent of change. Then a few years into his administration, it became abundantly clear. Serious investigation yielded no doubt as to which class President Obama was going to serve. And it's just gotten progressively worse with a so-called liberal, if you want to use that term. I try to stay away from those terms, in the White House. And this has led me to being a member of the Election Boycott Advocates, and it's ultimately led me to start questioning capitalism, to start, you know, realizing that it's the economic system that is producing a lot of the misery that the working class in America experience. And this is something that's not going to go away anytime soon. And, you know, I've attended a couple rallies, Workers' World Party rallies, with my good friend Pinko the Bear, who also hosts a radio show on the Commons Project Network and here on Blog Talk Radio. And I came across Fred Goldstein, who's a WWP member. I don't really know that much about Fred. I heard one of his lectures at a rally a few months ago, and I started to buy his books and read some of his work. And I got to tell you, it's really opened my eyes. It's really forced me to think in another direction, and I would consider Fred Goldstein to be one of my intellectual authorities that I draw influence from. I mean, there's a few of them. There's Peter Joseph of the Zeitgeist Movement. There's Ralph Nader, presidential candidate, author, public rights advocate. Tom Hartman, who I mentioned earlier. And, of course, Noam Chomsky. And now Fred Goldstein, because his work, he's a Marxist, and it's from a Marxist perspective. And his work is absolutely crucial, I think, in understanding the problems that we find ourselves in, and to understand that this is not going away anytime soon. I read his book a few months ago, Capitalism is at a Dead End. And I just kind of want to go over some of the concepts in there because, again, they're very, very important. In this book, he talks about the rate of hiring and firing cannot keep up with the technological advances. In other words, capital has forced labor to be so productive that the amount of workers displaced from technology cannot keep up with the hiring, and vice versa. And basically what this is amounted to is what is called jobless recoveries. We saw this from the first decade of the new century, from 2000 to 2010. Okay, we had 8-10 million less jobs, 8 or 10 million fewer jobs in the economy because of technology. Because again, capital has forced labor to be so productive that it cannot possibly keep up with hiring and firing. And so what has happened is the capitalists now have managed to squeeze more and more and more productivity out of fewer and fewer and fewer workers. Now tell me that's not something that the average person can't understand. Tell me that, if you're a worker out there like most of us, you make your wage or you make your living through a wage or a salary. You do not own the means of production. Tell me that you're not working more for less money. I mean, this is what we're seeing right now in America, where the average American is working more and more and more hours. Okay, we have less and less and less vacation time. Some Americans, including yours truly, have to work two jobs just to keep up with, the way that the marketplace is, and it's killing us. But it's an absolute necessity because of the economic system. Because again, as capital rises, and this is one of the things that Fred Goldstein talks about, he actually quotes it as one of Marx's laws, the law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. Basically, as capital continues to rise, productivity continues to – the cost of productivity continues to rise. Capital continues to rise. Workers are going to be squeezed by their employers to keep up with the rising cost of capital. Okay, and this is another concept that you don't have to be a college professor to understand. You don't have to be a Marxist professor or an expert to understand that things are getting more and more and more expensive. Technology is getting more and more and more expensive. And the capitalists that are in competition with one another, trying to gain market share, trying to increase the amount of sales over their competitor, or their competitor will take them over, their competitor will put them out of business, which is why a capitalist can never rest with the amount of profit that they make. This is what is happening, and this is why we see nothing but layoffs now. We see nothing but outsourcing. We see everything intended to basically reduce the wage cost for the capitalists out there. And this is all under the guise of remaining competitive. You know, we've seen this time and time again. We always see this layoffs of thousands of workers, right? A austerity agenda all across the country, all across the world. Cutting of pensions, right? You know, asking more and more and more concession from the workers. Well, this is because, again, the rate of profit for the capitalists continues to decline, and workers, capitalism has to drag us into the abyss so that it can continue to survive. And as Christopher Alan Driscoll, member of the Election Boycott Advocate, said on this program a few weeks ago when we were talking about this very issue, he basically said, you know, we have to come to a point in America where we say, we don't care about your rate of profit. You know, I don't care about, you know, some business owner, some corporation, some whatever, who is not content with just having enough for their own basic needs. I could care less about, you know, Walmart or Bank of America or any one of these multinational corporations' rate of profit if it comes before my life, if it comes before, you know, our well-being. And that's what we have in America. We have, and this is, you know, one of the fundamentals of capitalism. You know, this is an issue that we have not tackled, okay? But as long as we have this system in place that is based on profits, lives for the average American, you know, our lives are going to continue to deteriorate under the material conditions of capitalism. Okay, and you know, these are very, very important points that Fred Goldstein brings out in his book, and it's really forced me to look at, you know, the economic system much differently. You know, because before I read Fred Goldstein's book, I would just attribute this to greed. You know, I would say, and greed certainly is a big part of it. I mean, again, you know, if you're a millionaire, if you're someone that makes even $1 billion a year, which I think is harmful to society, you're a greedy person. Okay, there's no question about it. You have more money than it takes to live. Your money and the fact that you're hoarding all this money, I think, is a detriment to society. I think produces a whole host of negative activities, because money equals power in our society, and this is what the capitalists have managed to do. They've managed to make our so-called representative government absolutely meaningless. It's absolutely meaningless to the point where average workers, poor people in America, have no say whatsoever in legislation, in decisions, absolutely none whatsoever. I would just say, okay, you know, it's corporations being greedy. It's the wealthy not having enough. It's them not being satisfied with their possessions. But you know what? This is what the system demands. You know, this is what is necessitated by the economic system, and this is a constant. This is not going away. And so now that this is really, you know, because everything traces back to this, you know, I could only imagine you listening out there, you know, you're being told by your boss that you have to remain competitive. You have to do more with less. You have to, you know, basically do what we tell you to do, or else we're going to replace someone. We're going to replace you with a worker who's willing to work for less money, okay? And this is all legal. You don't get to work unless we can make, you know, more money off of you. We can increase our profits off of your labor. And we accept this as being, okay, yeah, this is the way it is. Well, you know, no, it doesn't have to be like that. You know, we do not have to just continue to work ourselves to death, you know, basically kill ourselves with this system just because it's arranged a certain way. There's always another way. And, you know, and so now I'm reading Fred Goldstein's new book, or not his new book, but it's new to me. It's called Low-Wage Capitalism, What the New Globalized High-Tech Imperialism Means for the Class Struggle for the U.S. And I've only gotten about one chapter in, okay? So I'm not that far in, but I can tell you that just based on the one chapter I've read, some of the points that Fred Goldstein has made have been spot on. And this book was released in 2008. I think just around the time of the financial collapse of 2008. And now we have a global workforce, okay? And the global workforce has doubled since 1980. You know, we always talked about Ronald Reagan, how in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was elected, it truly was a revolution in many respects. And you can make an argument that Reagan's election was really spurred on perhaps by the election of Margaret Thatcher in 1978, and her reign was truly revolutionary. And Reagan's reign was revolutionary, too, in a number of things. I mean, the tax rate, Reagan really lowered the tax rate to the point where it was at 1.28%. And when Reagan came in, it was 70%, which was historically low compared to what it was after World War II and whatnot. And by the way, you know, I mentioned the jobless recovery years ago, or 2000 to 2010. Well, from World War II up until about 1978, up until about 1980, we've experienced at least 20% more jobs each decade with a high tax rate and with a high rate of unionization. And that's a very, very important point. But, you know, since Ronald Reagan, I mean, all of these things sort of started to happen to really almost nail the final nail in the coffin of the American worker. You had the election of Ronald Reagan. You had a wave of deregulation, which resulted in the 1987 collapse, the SNL collapse, and resulted in a debt. You had the defeat of USSR, the Soviet Union, the fall of communism in the Soviet Union. And, you know, prior to that time, even, you know, after World War II, you had much of the world that was leaning towards socialism. Half of the world was leaning towards socialism, and the other half of the world was leaning more towards imperialism and whatnot. And you know, you had the collapse, which occurred in 1991. It didn't happen under Ronald Reagan, but you had the collapse of the Soviet Union and the globalization, the doubling of the global workforce. Okay, and what this has done is this has put us in wage competition with emerging markets, what you know, businesses consider emerging markets. And this has just absolutely deteriorated American workers, because one of the points that Fred Goldstein makes in his book, and we're seeing this in America time in and time again, is that a worker's pension, a worker's livable wage, which, again, has been under attack, particularly in the public sector over the past, you know, they're really cranking up the pressure over the past 6 or 7 years now, is overpriced in the world labor market. And this is according to the capitalists out there. Okay, so in other words, you have a unionized employee, in the public sector, the rate of unionization is much higher. And this worker has vacation time. This worker has a pension. This worker has health care and a livable wage with collective bargaining. In the world labor market, this is overpriced. This is something to be knocked down, because that capitalist, that owner can offshore that labor, can fragment the labor, which is another thing Fred Goldstein talks about, and ultimately, you know, produce that product, produce that service, whatever the worker is doing, for, you know, a tenth of the price. For he can really, really reduce the wage cost out there. And this is part of the value of labor, where the value of labor is similar to China, similar to Indonesia and the Philippines. And as long as the capitalists are allowed to do this, they will, as Fred Goldstein points out, push us in that direction until the workers stop us. In other words, we're going to continue to see the oppression of American workers. We're going to continue to see American workers being put on the chopping block, okay, until we are able to organize and say, you know, enough is enough. We have to completely rearrange the economic system out there and basically say the mobility of workers, the right to have a voice in the workplace, democracy over ownership, is more important than the profitability of these companies, okay? It's all about striving for profits. That's what it is. And this is also part of the revolutionizing of the means of production. Another important point that Karl Marx, you know, mentioned in, I believe, in the Communist Manifesto, where, you know, basically the capitalists will have to come up with new ways to increase their profits. Technology is a good example. Technology has rendered the skills of workers meaningless. Okay, technology has basically stagnated wages. It has been used to increase the profits. It is in the hands of the capitalist class. We don't own technology. Technology solves problems. You know, we, as Christopher Alan Driscoll pointed out in the show, we have the technology to produce what Harry Kasson of the Zeitgeist Movement would call the communist utopia, but we don't have the political consciousness to do it, because the technology, which, by the way, much of the technology has been produced by taxpayer-funded research, you know, taxpayer funds directly, okay, you know, you could look at just about everything, and you could see our dollars, our tax dollars at work, but it's ultimately in the hands of the capitalists out there, okay? And every boom and bust cycle, particularly in 2000, in 2008, has been accompanied by some sort of technological advance, okay? And that's another, you know, important point there. But, you know, basically, we don't have control over anything anymore. And technology has displaced workers. It's made labor so productive. But one of the contradictions of capitalism is that we can produce and produce and produce, but really produce nothing. A good example of this is the derivatives market. You know, prior to the financial collapse of 2008, the derivatives market was $10 trillion. If you go back to prior to when all the deregulation took place, which, by the way, most of the key deregulation took place under the Clinton administration. Okay, Clinton reinvented the way that government works and whatnot. It was $10 trillion. Now it's over $600 trillion in nothing tangible, in these fake, arguably toxic, well, they are toxic, arguably fraudulent assets known as derivatives. And it's completely dwarfed our GDP. It's, you know, 50, 60 times higher, I don't know what the exact number is, than the world GDP. And it's absolutely nothing. So the capitalist system, which would be grinded to a halt by overproduction and mass unemployment, according to Karl Marx, is producing things that we don't need. We don't need these toxic assets. We don't need these derivatives. We, by and large, don't need Wall Street at all, okay? You can make an argument that investment in Wall Street may produce some value for society, but people don't go to work on Wall Street for the betterment of society. They go to work on Wall Street for the movement of money, which doesn't benefit society at all, does not produce life-sustaining goods in our economy, okay? And the fact that it is the most rewarded sector of the economy really tells you something about the capitalist system. It really does. And, you know, it is all for the profits of the capitalist class, not for the betterment of society. This speaks, again, to the economic system. Perhaps if we had a different economic system, perhaps if we had a more of a social democracy, we would see technology be used for the betterment of society. But we don't. We don't because we have not really addressed capitalism in any meaningful way. You know, the Tea Party, as Alan Moss points out in his book, The Case for Socialism, they're not a single-issue group. They hate minorities. They hate the government. They hate immigrants. They hate and hate and hate. They're not single-issue people. Now, we shouldn't be either. We should, instead of focusing on single issues, the underlying priorities of the capitalist system, we should address capitalism as a whole, address the economic system. You know, I saw Selma last week, okay? I was the only person in the theater to see this movie. I went early, about 12 o'clock, and it was great. I sat right up in the front. And it was a really inspiring movie, about over two hours and nine minutes long, okay? But, you know, I almost have to basically throw the effort under the bus because, you know, voting in this system is not going to bring about the justice that we need, which is economic justice. You know, I think it was Lenin that said that, a wise man said, you're not going to bring about socialism through the ballot box, okay? And they're absolutely correct. It's like, you know, the whole march, the whole Selma march and the crossing of the bridge and all the brutality that African Americans had to suffer at the hands of a white power structure, ultimately protecting the capitalist system. It was noble, but the end result, the end goal of voting, of participating in the electoral process, which is owned by the capitalist class, capitalist elections, a capitalist a government, capitalist military, it's meaningless because, you know, you don't have equality under the law unless you have economic equality. Economic equality is everything. Okay, and that's something that Dr. King started to figure out later on in his life, but it's something that Malcolm knew, you know, pretty early on. Malcolm was a realist about our system. He was a realist about human nature and the nature of the white man and whatnot. And so, you know, that's what one of the things that we really have to – another thing that we have to do is drive people away from the capitalist system, drive people away, drive workers away – from the Democratic Party, which is one of the major capitalist parties. That's what we have to do. You know, we need to do it through revolutionary means and not participating in the election system, exercising noncompliance. And noncompliance is a very, very important word because it doesn't mean, you know, basically standing in front of a police car or injuring yourself. It doesn't mean, you know, killing two police officers, as we saw a few months ago in New York City, a disgusting act. It doesn't mean violence, although it can. What it means is not complying with the system. You know, not accepting the fundamentals of the system, not accepting the system as being legitimate, because our economic system is not legitimate. And how do you know that capitalism is not legitimate? Look at where all the rewards have gone. Look at where all of the income growth has gone. It's all gone to the top 1%. They've sucked trillions and trillions of dollars out of us. Okay? It's like watching a Harlem Globetrotters game where the Harlem Globetrotters always win. Always does. Let's go back to the individual that called at the beginning of the show. Hey, my friend, how are you?
Hey, what's going on?
Good, brother. Did you have anything that you wanted to comment on?
I mean, you covered. I mean, you. I wish there were a lot of people who understood the situation like you do. I'm actually about a little over a quarter of the way through The Unseen Hand. I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
No.
You never read the Unseen Hand?
No. Who's it about? Or who wrote it?
I think it's Ralph Epperson, I want to say.
Okay.
Basically, it just goes through, you know, how the capitalist, overthrew the nobility of Europe, and then, basically tried to, and I'm sure you're aware, you know, with the whole Federal Reserve and
right.
The First Bank of America and the Second Bank and trying to assassinate Andrew Jackson.
Right.
And then, you know, starting World War One, how J.P. Morgan got involved and all type of stuff, and, you know, how people were influenced by Marx. And, I mean, it was just, it goes through the whole thing. But basically, ultimately, you know, it's about, you know, capitalism and how the capitalists control everything. And the world that we live in is really a plutocracy. It's not a democracy, as you were saying earlier.
Right.
And personally, what I think is going to happen is I think that the capitalists are going to become so powerful that, I mean, well, they already are. I mean, like you said, you know, with the lobbyists and things like that, you know, and a person that I would quote is Marcus Garvey, where he said, show me your economic situation and I'll show you your political situation.
Yep.
And you know, that's the situation that we exist in. And essentially what I see in the future is I see a situation where, I mean, essentially they should just take a big factory and put it on a barge that's movable.
Yep.
And simply move to a different, you know, third world country and then
yep.
sit off the shore of that country for about 50 years until the economic standards of living of that country go up. And then when those people demand too much, like America is right now, right, you know, oh, they're demanding too much. Okay, move the barge and then, you
yeah.
know, go to Africa or go to another, you know, third world country and then develop that for 50 years. And then when they start demanding too much, just simply move to, you know, somewhere else. And so, you know, we're going to end up with a situation where essentially you're going to have corporations that are governments, that have private military corporations that are going to be PMCs,
yep.
that are going to run everything like Eon Flux or something like that. And, you know, you're just going to have, you know, this type of world where it's broken off into sections that corporations control. It's not going to be controlled by governments. I mean, you can always...
Yeah.
The thing is, you know, to get rid of capitalism, you know, or to turn the whole thing around, I mean, the ideal situation would be a resource-based economy, but any sort of change like that, I mean, you're talking a whole bunch of bloodshed, you know, because you can always pay half the poor to kill the other half. And
right.
I see that even with America, you know, where you have, it's not even really haves between the have-nots. It's like, the haves are the oligarchs that are way at the top. They convince the people who they gave a couple of peanuts that they have, you know, obviously they have more, but they don't, they're still a slave to the system. They just don't realize it. They just have more.
Yep.
It's almost like the example of, you know, an overseer versus the slaves. You know, an overseer, you know, is still like, if you think about slavery undermined the working man. Because
right.
why would I pay you if I can get a slave to work for me for free? So
right.
in order to not have, you know, let's say a poor white Southerner recognize that and overthrow the system, like as was the case in Bacon's Rebellion, you know, you basically give them,
you know, an honorary badge and a whip and a hat, and you say, here, look, you know, you have more. Keep them in place, and I'll, you know, give you, you know, this little lot of land and this and that, and you'll be cool. And,
yep.
Yeah, people will be cool for that for a time being, but I think that eventually people will come together and recognize what's going on. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, there's a lot of tribalism in the, that goes on in the world. There's a lot of group economics that goes on in the world, and that's just a part of capitalism. But eventually and hopefully people will recognize what they have in common, the commonality of interest, and recognize that they're all being screwed. And, you know, essentially, you know, people will become sick and tired of being sick and tired. And in order to basically get rid of a system like capitalism, you would have to have a global strike, literally a global strike where we're so organized and every single working person basically says, we're not doing this anymore. You know, but like I said,
yeah.
You can always pay half the poor to kill, you know, the other half. Like you can look at the situation with, you know, Carnegie and what was the guy's name? Fisk. And with the steel mill, and I believe it was, I don't know if it was Pittsburgh. I think it was outside of Pittsburgh. But with the, you know, the workers who went on strike and the Pinkertons that they sent in to basically bust up the strike because they were blocking the factory. I'm saying
right.
That's gone. You know, people today seem to forget. You know, they always want to talk about people being lazy or a certain group of people being lazy, but Americans seem to forget that everything that they have right now was fought for. It was not given. It wasn't
right.
Given out of the goodness of the corporation's heart. If it was up to the corporations, you know, children as young as 7 years old would be working as they were, you know, in the late 1800s, right?
Right.
You know, that's why we came up with child labor laws. There was
yep.
No 40-hour work week. That was fought for. There were no pensions. There was no health care. There were no benefits. There were no weekends. There were no paid holidays. All these things were fought for, and
right.
And I think that, you know, people forget that. They really believe, you know, now I think that the whole, you know, because obviously the corporations and, you know, just like they control the government, they control the media, they've gone out here and they've convinced people, you know, that those people are being lazy or, you know, those people are taking your taxpayer dollars and, you know, just, you know, wasting it and this and that. And I'm not saying that that doesn't go on and you don't have people who take advantage of the system, but I'm
yeah.
saying they're using that and exploiting that to create that divide and conquer situation
yeah.
so that the have-nots don't recognize, look, we're all being screwed. We're all in the same boat. So
yep. It's class division.
Yeah.
It's one of the underlying priorities of the capitalists out there, the class division. You know, and what worries me, and by the way, what's your name?
Peter.
Peter, okay. What worries me, Peter, is that we've seen uprisings in the past. I mean, we saw the Occupy movement, okay? Now, this was, I would argue, largely a response to income inequality, but largely a response to capitalism itself. They were asking the right questions. They were, you know, shining the light on income inequality and the unfairness of our economic system. And what happened? You know, it was President Obama and the Democrats, largely Democratic mayors across America, that used the private sector to disband the Occupy protests. And now, you know, as Paul Street said, we didn't have an Occupy movement. We had an Occupy moment, and this was when we had President Obama in the White House, a so-called liberal in the White House that is casted as this progressive, even though, as I mentioned earlier, serious investigation yields little doubt as to what class President Obama served.
Well,
and then
I'll tell you what the – go ahead.
No, and I was just going to say, and then you had the Ferguson rebellion – which, you know, was, again, a response to police brutality. But as the crisis of capitalism continues, as workers get more and more and more desperate, you're seeing a ramping up of the police state. You're seeing money. You're seeing weaponry. You're seeing everything that the ruling class could do to control the population.
Yeah, which is why they wanted to use Sandy Hook to disarm the population, because they know a fight is coming. I mean, I think the issue with the problem with the Occupy Wall Street was it was a lot of young and unemployed people who were out there who were doing the whole Occupy Wall Street. And that was the problem, because I mean, these are people who, if you ask me what the next bubble is going to be, it's going to be the college bubble. It's going to be the bubble of all these people who went to college, got the degrees, you know, anywhere from, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 in debt. I mean, when I came out as an undergrad, that was $100,000 because it was about $20,000 per semester.
Right.
Or no, $20,000 per year.
Right.
Overall, it was about $100,000 that I came out in debt with. And my parents, you know, have helped me substantially in terms of, you know, paying that off. But if my parents weren't in the financial position, you know, that they're in to help me, my kids would be, you know, in a hole. And I'm saying the market, capitalism, and it's not just capitalism, it's any system of where we have this, you know, fractional reserve banking type of situation going on. It's based on infinite growth. There has to be infinite growth. If we were going to Mars right now and we were mining Mars and everything, it would be a golden age. If we were expanding out to other planets and everything, you know, you could do anything because it would just be infinite growth, and capitalism wouldn't be so much of an issue because there would just be an abundance of, you know, everything that's around. It might still be an issue, but I'm saying it wouldn't be as much as it is now. But as you were saying, you know, with technology, I mean, people aren't thinking. I'm like, what do you think, that everything's just going to max out with computers and laptops? No, it's going to max out when, you know, you have the iRobot situation or this new movie called Chappie, where now you got robots that are doing the labor, and then it's going to put a whole bunch of people out. And people aren't even considering this. They're like, oh, that's so far in the future, blah, blah, blah. And I'm okay.
That's one of the points. We have another caller. We're going to go to them in a second. But that's one of the things that Fred Goldstein mentions, is that now you have computers through the DARPA program. You have computers that are able to drive cars now and make deliveries. And it's really, really scary. It's being used against us.
There goes your mailman and your taxi drivers.
Exactly.
And your delivery guys.
It's really, really scary. Hey, listen, man, thanks for the call. And please, I encourage you to friend me on Facebook. It's facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. What town are you from, by the way?
Philadelphia.
Oh, cool. You're close to me. I'm from New Jersey. So, yeah, we encourage you to participate. Call us back anytime. And if you can, friend me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter, and we could communicate that way, my friend. We need like-minded individuals to go forward, I think.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Take care, Peter. All right. Let's, let's go to somebody else who just called in again. This is probably via Skype. Hello. Welcome to Carson's Corner.
How you doing, man?
Hey, what's up?
Not much. Just called in listening to the show, and, you know, interesting points by the caller. I think you can just look at that and say that right now that's just a function of what capitalism is going to be. So any industry you have, they're going to set aside a small group in a room, and they're going to, you know, the bean counters are going to figure out ways to make the company more profitable, and there's going to be no idea about what it will do to jobs, because that's never a concern. It'll just be about, okay, we got a self-checkout line. No idea about, okay, you're losing X amount of cashiers or anything, and every industry is built on that. And to touch on his other point about, you know, no new territory to be discovered, that's basically, you're talking about the age of imperialism. You're talking about there was always a new land to go and exploit and grab everything from. And now, you know, you got everybody's pretty much decided where the lines are. All the territory's been carved up, and everybody's planted their flag. Where do they go from here? Essentially, you're talking about the standard of living going down for, you know, the majority of the people, because these things are built on the interests of the few who have the most. And as long as they're dictating things, that's the way this thing is going to stay in motion. So the good thing about it is they always overreach, and that's why we've always seen empires fall. So that's the good part, I guess you could say. But, of course, who the hell wants to be around when an empire falls? Because that's typically some really bad times. But
it's like socialism or barbarism, you know. And I think you're absolutely right. But what do you think is ultimately going to happen? I mean, it's just basically we're going to have another collapse of the capitalist system, and then it's going to be whoever's there to pick up the pieces. Or do you think it's I don't think we're going to experience a real gradual change. I think it's going to, you know, accelerate to the point where the workers have reached their breaking point and they really opt for radical solutions. But what do you think is going to happen?
I think it's Eugene O'Neill, the Iceman Cometh. As you get more fascist and as you get more direct about the things you do, you don't have to cover them so much and so much propaganda. You just outright say, look, we have to go over here and take this. Otherwise, it's going to be rough for you people to have a job. And before you know it, just thinking about what we know as the American citizenry, I think people will start to turn towards that type of fascist mentality and be fully behind it. Like, okay, if we got to mess them up to get X, Y, and Z, then we're down for it. And, you know, I think you could easily see that swung that way. And military power is the answer for any declining empire. So that's pretty much, you know, that's our bag now at this point. I think we're going to see this thing last for a little while longer than what some people are projecting. Just because you don't have the number one military power in the world and just say, oh, okay, you guys outsmarted me. As we all know, when power gets outsmarted, it goes to force. So it's not going to be that China and India have just basically shown that they're going to be way more competitive and way more important as far as finance. The United States, no matter what, at the end of the day, is going to say, I have this hammer. So.
Yeah. I totally agree, and that's something that really, you know, I got to tell you though, I am encouraged by what is happening in Greece over the, you know, with the election of Syriza and Alex Tsipras and all of the events going on there. There are, I think, countries that are starting to fight back, and as Peter from Philadelphia spoke about in the previous call, where we're going to need basically a global effort. He called it a global strike to really, really overturn things. And I think that maybe we're starting to see some glimmers of hope. Although in the United States, I think we're blissfully unaware of what's happening right now. It's really unfortunate. You're starting to see some uprising, but it's been nullified by the ruling class. But you know what? I'm glad there are people out there like us that really, you know, and I'm sure you're in the same boat when I say that it's difficult to find anybody to have any type of discussion like we're having right now. I mean, on the corporate media, I haven't seen any type of any similar type of discussion out there on the real important issues. You know, instead I talk about John Stewart. I hear talk about, you know, what this politician said or that politician said. And it seems like people like us are really in the fight.
Yeah, well, that's the good thing about it, though, because in the few organizations I've been in and the little bit of work that I've done, I'm not going to present myself as some type of activist 24/7.
Right.
But the thing I've learned from people, especially older people, is it's in the doing. It's in the doing because you have to understand it's bigger than you and everything doesn't have to change in your lifetime. But if you put your work in and just, you know, move things forward as much as you can during your lifetime and just, you know, do the work but still enjoy your life, you know that a better day will come for another generation.
Now,
it's not doom and gloom. That's just being realistic about things and understanding that your place in history is just your place in history. Everybody's not born on the eve of the French Revolution. You know what I mean? Like, you don't choose that. You kind of just have to deal with the cards you've been dealt. So you just put your time in, do your work, and that work will fulfill you. And I think a lot of activists get burned out because they start to take on that messiah complex and think that everything goes through them. But it's a tough thing to be concerned with because it's a lot easier to just veg out on TV and junk food and, you know, not concern yourself with the things. But you'll get a lot more from actually being involved and deciding that you want to see a different world.
Well said, well said. A new world is possible for sure. Listen, thanks for the call. Give us your name and town before you go.
Oh, I'm Naj, and I'm in Atlanta.
Awesome, awesome. Well, thanks a lot for calling, Naj. And if you can, check me out. Friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. And thanks for calling again.
Indeed. Good night.
Take care. You know, it's great. We have some real, real intellectual callers out there. I really, really enjoy you know, hearing all of these perspectives. And I'm thinking maybe we should start broadcasting late at night, because a lot of times when I broadcast, you know, prime time hours, 8, 9 o'clock, you don't get a lot of people calling in. I think there's some, and Pinko the Bear, who I also also am on the Commons Project Network with, and he's more of a full-time activist, although he recently got a job where he works 50 to 60 hours a week, so he's doing a lot less rallies, and but he's still nonetheless, you know, pretty fairly close with the folks over at the WWP and a lot of other groups out there. And Pinko is really, really got his ear to the ground. He broadcasts at night as well, and he gets a lot of people calling in. So I think this is going to be a new beginning here for Carson's Corner in terms of the time, because I'm a night owl, okay? I like staying into the night, studying, reading, do whatever I have to do in preparation. And then tomorrow I got to wake up and I got to go to my menial wage slave job, which I'm just struggling to keep. I mean, literally, I've been in this place for about 4 or 5 years now, okay? And like any worker out there, you do more and more and more for the company. You do more and more and more for the capitalist owner in one form or another, and their only responsibility is to pay you a wage. That's it. That's all I have to do is pay you a wage. You, on the other hand, have to risk life, limb, and everything else during oftentimes the prime of your life. You are not entitled to anything other than a wage, and certainly you do not get the full value. You do not get nearly the value that you produce for your owner, and that's what it is. It's economic, and I will use it. It's economic slavery. I think it is. You know, capitalism is a form of slavery. There's no question about it. And some people might object to that term, but you know what? Workers do not have any rights. Workers, you know, you think about your employer. I work for a major retailer, okay? And the idea that, oh, you just have the right, you just have the opportunity to go to another place. Hey, Bob, you know, if you don't like your job, go to another place. Go to another retail. Let the market work it out for you, right? Well, that's the most ridiculous thing ever, because first of all, my retailer knows the ins and outs of the labor law. My retailer, they hire consultants. They spend millions, if not billions of dollars on consultants, okay? They write the damn law. They write the damn tax code. Why do you think our tax code is over 70,000 pages? It's because of major corporations that have turned the state into, you know, their financier. Remember, this is one of the things Fred Goldstein talks about, how the capitalist class have turned the government into a debtor, which makes them have more control over the United States government. And what we're seeing now when it comes to social spending and paying off the interest off the debt of the debt, social spending will always be on the chopping block, which is why we've seen austerity. We've seen thousands of kids kicked off of Head Start. We've seen the unemployment situation continue to get worse, regardless of the economic abstractions that are given to us. We continue to see, you know, poor people pay, as we always do. It's always the poor that pay for the wealthiest. The rich is opulence. There's no question about that. We have another caller. I'm not sure if we can get him in here. Welcome to Carson's Corner.
No, it's still me. The line hung up when you I guess you were trying to put me on mute.
Oh, no problem, brother. Well, we got about a minute left, but again, thanks for calling, and I wish you the best of the rest of the week, my friend.
Thanks, you too.
Take care. All right, yeah, so I want to encourage you to check out the Election Boycott Advocates every Sunday here on Carson's Corner. The Election Boycott Advocates.weebly.com, the Election Boycott Advocates.weebly.com. That is the website of our group. You can find out more about our activities there. I want to encourage you to check out the Commons Project Network for like-minded programming. Again, that's the Commons Project Network.com. Which this show is on. And I want to encourage you to friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. That's facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Thanks to Naj from Atlanta for calling, and thanks to Peter from Philadelphia for calling, too. Very intellectual callers who I definitely think agree with me in a lot of things. There were some – I heard some sort of zeitgeist tenets in some of these calls, and we've been a big supporter of some of the tenets laid out by Peter Joseph and the Zeitgeist Movement. In fact, Harry Kaysen, who is a member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement and also a political professor, frequently appears on this program. So it's good to see the consciousness spreading out there. All right, until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect. This is Bob Carson of Carson's Corner.